Support for Radio Boston comes from Hadestown at the Box Center Wang Theater, Broadway's Tony and Grammy-winning Best Musical, an epic celebration of music, togetherness, and hope, raves Forbes. Playing April 23rd through April 28th. Buy your tickets today at boxcenter.org.
This is Radio Boston. I'm Tiziana Deering. How are you this morning, Greater Boston? It is a tough morning. The pain of the loss and violence. As of this morning, 19 of our children and two teachers dead in Texas. That has traveled here and it has hit us hard. And we are a community here on Radio Boston, and we wanted to come together today, grieve, reflect, find some way to put out on our kitchen table here all that we're feeling, all the questions we still need to answer, and yet another terrible moment. And the weight of it feels heavier given the context. It's the two-year anniversary of the murder of George Floyd, less than 2 weeks after a young white man massacred black grocery shoppers in Buffalo. And of course, you can't not juxtapose that as well. So listen, we have a conversation today with U.S. Attorney Rachel Rollins, who was Suffolk County DA when George Floyd was murdered, and talked then passionately with us on Radio Boston about it. We wanted to reflect with her 2 years on, and we will do that. But right now, Reverend Mariama White Hammond is with us in the studio here. She is the founding pastor of the New Roots AME Church in Dorchester. And she's going to help us talk this through, because that's what we do as community. So welcome back, Reverend Mariama.
It's good to be here. Wish it was a different circumstance.
Me too. And I'm glad you're here, though. And I want to just start by asking you how you are.
You know, I ultimately I'm well. You know, I woke up this morning. I got my prayer time. I made it to my yoga, online yoga class. I'm good, but my heart is heavy.
You said that you got your prayer time this morning. We are of many faiths in the Radio Boston community, some agnostic, some atheist, some practicing any of a number of faiths. In yours, is there a biblical context, a quote, something that you've turned to in this moment?
So I think I have been thinking about praying for the families. The odd juxtaposition is, Our congregation is in the midst of celebrating graduations for folks who've sort of reached that milestone in school.
High school, middle school,
college. We have someone who just finished their dissertation, is graduating, and we're collecting all the names for graduation Sunday. And so we've been thinking about school as a milestone. And of course, then we have this moment. One of my parishioners said, I just can't send my kids to school today. You know, and so folks are praying with her and for her. But, you know, I have been preaching in the Beatitudes. And so looking at this notion that God is present for those who mourn, for those who are suffering, I've been thinking a lot about that, about the reality that I truly believe that God is closest to, present, available with those who are really struggling. But I also have to be honest, I also not just prayed for those who are suffering, but really asking God, how have we come to the point in this country where this is just normal, where we're going to likely have a few moments of silence, and then move on without doing anything. I think that's the thing that makes me most angry and heartbroken. And so I prayed for the callousness, or how, what I perceive to be the callousness. I looked the book of Exodus, and the moment where it talks about how, you know, Moses first goes to Pharaoh, and he doesn't actually first ask for the people to be freed from slavery. Actually, what he just says is, will you allow us to go worship our God in the wilderness? That's the ask. And Pharaoh says, no. And the scriptures tell us about how Pharaoh's heart is hardened. I think we all tend to identify ourselves as the Israelites, right? The people who are, you know, with God and who are suffering. But in many ways, I feel like as a nation, we've become a bit of a pharaoh in the way that our policies are working. Because even in light of children dying, we have not taken action. Somehow, the hearts, and I want to make a distinction because I think a large majority of Americans want common sense changes in our gun laws. But I looked at that point and then I sort of said to God, like, what is it going to take? Because I feel like we're already losing our firstborn children. And somehow we are still not shifting.
There's a lot there that I want to talk to you about. And I feel like to start, one of the things I've been struggling with all morning is my intense need, my intense experience of this moment with these children, and the fact that there are lots of moments right here in Boston where our children die, mm-hmm. and I'm not doing this the next morning on the show. And we're not always having the same conversation about a collective shared experience as parents. And I'm not looking for forgiveness from you for that or permission from you for that, but I am asking if you'll reflect with me on that.
Yeah, it's very real. Unfortunately, throughout my year, I remember the young people that I've lost. On my birthday every year, I remember a young person who was part of my program, Kareem Burry, who was killed the morning of my birthday, so I never forget. It's always this moment of celebration for me of another year, but also remembrance that Kareem never had another birthday. He'll never have a 29th birthday. He'll never have a 42nd birthday. He'll never live to be six. So it is this reality that we live in a society where too many of our children are considered expendable. And, you know, we've been wrestling in our community around the, you know, Supreme Court case and this idea of pro-life and what does that mean? And, you know, our congregants, you know, land in different places. But what's really hard for me in my own tradition is the hypocrisy of our willingness to fight for children that are not here and our lack of motivation to fight for children that are already here. And so, yeah, I do want to figure out what does it mean to be a truly pro-child country, that we never let the passing of our children go unnoticed. And you are right. Living in a community that, you know, it is better now than it was when I was in high school. But I remember going to funerals and wearing the buttons, and it almost has become a rite of passage for so many of our kids to have lost somebody. And maybe some piece of me thought, when all of America begins to experience this, we will change. Maybe what's most overwhelming for me is that even when white children in suburban America are gunned down, we still have been unwilling to shift the hold of the gun lobby on our country. So yeah, it is hard. It is hard because I mourn for kids that never showed up in the newspaper and who there wasn't a collective moment of silence, sometimes even in their own schools, much less in the city.
Yeah. We're talking to Reverend Mariama White Hammond, who's the founding pastor at the New Roots AME Church in Dorchester, and someone we turn to often here on Radio Boston to grapple, to understand, to sit in discomfort.
Mm-hmm.
We reached out. We have a texting group, and people sign up to become part of it. And
yeah.
I texted that group today and said, hey, reflect if you want with us. And we got a couple in, and I want to share one of them with you now. This is Coomera in Northampton. I grew up in the town next door to Newtown, Sandy Hook.
Mm-hmm.
People told us growing up that Columbine was a one-off and it had never happened in the Northeast. Then it did. Then people said it couldn't happen in other states, and then it did, even states that love guns and gun rights. The hurt that a mass school shooting can cause stretches for years after in many ways no one thinks of, and it never matters what community you're from. This culture of it will never happen in my community. Sorry, this culture of it will never happen in my community needs to stop and shift to it may only be a matter of time unless things change. That's Coomera, and it resonates with some of the things that you just said. In our remaining time, you talked about becoming a pro-child nation. Okay, we're in Boston,
mm-hmm.
and we're not that big,
mm-hmm.
and we have a lot of resources here,
mm-hmm.
and we're at the table. What do we do to become a more pro-child city?
Yeah. So I think there's a lot of things that we need to focus on. So there's this question of our schools and making sure that our schools have everything that they need, which is financial resources, but it's also the ability of communities to come around our schools, to make them spaces where kids feel deeply valued. I think there's policies around childcare. I can't tell you how many folks I know, how many parents are stressed trying to take care of their kids. And, you know, one of the things I remember being really powerful about my growing up at the time, probably, and I thought wasn't so great, but now I recognize, I remember I used to always be a little afraid to get in trouble because I was like, you never know who might know my parents and who might say, what are you doing?
Parents.
It's true. But I actually think I want to live in a country where children know that if they are being naughty and if they are also in trouble and need help, the adults around them will rise up to make sure that they have what they need. I've been on the train where young people are arguing and about to get in a fight, and the adults are all moving back from them, like almost giving them the space to fight. So I think I want to be explicit. We need basic gun background checks in this country. It is a no-brainer, and it is about protecting our children. It's about protecting us all. So I want to be really clear. From a policy perspective, there are policies that would make our children safe. There are the way we spend our resources to make sure that our kids have everything they need. And then there's the work that every single one of us needs to do to, as we see children walking through the street, I don't care what color they are or how old they are, they feel like every adult takes responsibility for them as much as for their own. And that, I think if we had that kind of empathy, I'm not sure that our leaders could look away. I'm not sure that they would feel that they could continue to not act. And we would not rise up and say, if it's happening to any child, we require you to take leadership and do something about it.
That makes me think of the first time that Mona Lisa Smith of Mothers for Justice and Equality said to me, all children are our children. Every child is your child. Every child is my child. That feels like in a greater Boston community, that could become something we embrace.
It has to be.
Every child is our child.
It has to be. You know, one of the things I will say, my congregation on Sunday was processing buffalo, right? Which is what I'm like, I don't even know what I'm preaching about this Sunday, but obviously we got to figure this out.
This is the Tufts grocery store shooting of buffalo.
Yeah. And one of the things I said to them, we are a multiracial congregation, which is a very odd thing. We're half people of color, half white. And I said, one of the things that makes us strange when we go out and do like apple picking or other events is people are not used to seeing a little black child running up to a white family. They know who they are. People are not used to an older Black woman being helped by a younger white. They're not used to the kinds of relationships our community has because we are a church family. And I think we need more spaces where we are building those kinds of deep and empathetic relationships. And I think we also need to figure out, we don't know enough about the motive of this young person, but what we do know is that they were not well. What are we doing about the fact that there are folks in our community that are not well? And it should not be allowed to get to the point this far down the line without some level of intervention. That's another layer we need to figure out.
There is so much more I want to talk to you about. We are a one-hour show. So for today, that's it. But I know there will be more. And we called you last minute. I want to acknowledge that on air, right? Thank you for coming in to do this. We really were trying to figure out the voice we wanted, and you were it, and I appreciate it. Reverend Mariama White-Hammond, founding pastor at the New Roots AME Church in Dorchester, thank you.
Thank you.
We have been processing the tragedy in Texas together. As of this morning, 19 children, two teachers, died during an elementary school shooting yesterday, and that shooting comes less than 2 weeks after a massacre at a grocery store in Buffalo. And on top of all of that, today marks 2 years since Minneapolis police murdered George Floyd, sparking a global outcry, days of protest against our nation's racism, including here on the streets of our greater Boston cities and towns. We want to make sure to recognize that moment as well. So just a few days after Floyd was killed, Rachel Rollins joined us here on Radio Boston. Then she was Suffolk County DA. And she passionately called out what happened, called for fundamental changes in the way we practice law enforcement, especially with Black communities. Today, Rollins is U.S. Attorney for Massachusetts. A lot has happened in the past 2 years, so we wanted to invite her to reflect on all of it. We caught up with her earlier this week, before this latest tragedy, and I started by playing a bit of her initial reaction in the days after the murder of George Floyd.
Just profound sadness and honestly, just rage, quite frankly. This man has done more in that 8 minutes that he tried, convicted, sentenced, and executed George Floyd. He set back law enforcement at least 50 years by his action.
So she listened to that, and then I asked her, does she still believe that?
I firmly believe that when I said it, and I will say, watching the trial and seeing all of those members of law enforcement come forth and testify against, quite frankly, Derek Chauvin was a positive step in the right direction, because I don't believe, I know, Tiziana, that he does not represent law enforcement. That is not who the overwhelming majority of good men and women that do an honorable job every day and are culturally competent, he doesn't reflect them.
You know, I wondered if you would say that, because, of course, when you said 50 years setback, we didn't yet know what was going to happen in the, you know, days, weeks, months, even, you know, 2 years after that. And I think now, if I had told you that day that less than a year later, Chauvin would be convicted, would you have believed that even possible at that time?
I don't know if I would have, but remember, did you believe he was going to be convicted? Look, I've been the chief law enforcement officer of Suffolk County and now of all of Massachusetts on the federal side. People were afraid that this man was not going to be convicted after we all watched, and we now know it's 9 minutes and 29 seconds, we watched an execution. And there has been, unfortunately, a lot of things that happened after that fact. Amir Locke was Minneapolis. Amir Locke had a license to carry, and there was a no-knock warrant effectuated. He was not the individual that the police were looking for, but Amir Locke was killed when he had a firearm in his hand after a no-knock warrant, meaning they don't knock before they kick the door off the hinges. He had a license to carry. Does the Castle Doctrine apply to Black people?
I actually don't know what the Castle Doctrine is.
The Castle Doctrine, and I apologize.
That's all right.
There are some sort of relics of old, like the Castle Doctrine, where you are permitted to defend your castle, your home. There are other ones like we saw with Ahmaud Arbery, where certain states have laws on the books where people can effectuate a citizen's arrest. That's what Travis and Gregory McMichael and Roddy Bryan claimed they were doing falsely with respect to Ahmaud Arbery. So all of these sort of stand your ground, castle doctrine, citizen's arrest theories and statutes that are on the books, they don't only apply to white people. They apply to everyone if they're on the books. So my point is that there was a murder, quite frankly, a killing of Amir Locke in February in Minneapolis when a no-knock warrant was effectuated and he had a license to carry. If somebody kicks down your door, and I hope they don't, Tiziana, and you have a firearm and a license to carry, you can fire upon that individual, right? We've seen this happen across the country many, many times where people are defending their home. You know, when we look at Trayvon Martin and George Zimmerman, George claimed stand your ground. Well, did Trayvon Martin have a right to stand his ground? There are these concepts that we have to start having really uncomfortable conversations where, you know, when does the Second Amendment apply? Does the Second Amendment apply to everyone or only certain people? Does the Castle Doctrine apply to everyone or only certain people? So I think we've gotten a little bit better since George Floyd was murdered, but that summer was awful. We had Ahmaud Arbery. We had Breonna Taylor, which, of course, was a no-knock warrant where she was killed in her home asleep. We had George Floyd, and then recently we've had Buffalo, and there has been some coverage on that, but not as much as other murders that have happened. I've looked at the Globe. There have been on the cover page of the Globe multiple times, which is also a tragedy, is the bicyclist that died in Texas, which we need to hear about that too. 10 people died in Buffalo and were killed by a white supremacist. And there are people that feel as if, are their stories being told? Are we numb to this circumstance? And that's what I get fearful of.
I want to pick up a couple of things. And first, just for listeners, so Amir Locke, that case is February 2nd, 2022. He was fatally shot, so listeners know. And the cyclist is from Vermont, was shot and killed, a competitive cyclist, a woman in Texas. Just for listeners for that. You're talking about it, and I don't mean this dismissively. I mean this very seriously. You're talking about, in part, how we frame the incidents that we're talking about, and that's really resonating. Last Friday, we did a conversation here in Studio 2. Tito Jackson and Joan Vanacki were with us. We were talking about the conversations we need to have in Boston after the Topps grocery store shooting in Buffalo. And Tito Jackson talked a lot about, once again, the language that the media and law enforcement were using to describe the shooter there as an 18-year-old white shooter who was referred to as troubled and isolated and a boy and a teenager
right. with mental health issues.
Right. So,
and Michael Brown, who was 18 years old and hadn't killed anyone, was described as an 18-year-old black man.
That's exactly what Tito Jackson was talking about. And the other piece of this, so bear with me for a second. The other piece of this is I remember very vividly that first time we talked with you after George Floyd's murder, that you called it murder then. And I remember being very struck by the fact that as a DA, you were going to come straight out and frame it, call it murder. You're talking about the fact that we've made some progress in the last 2 years, but how we frame things, it sounds like you're saying, still really deeply reveals racism and inequality in how we see incidents that unfold.
I'm not even implying that there's intent there. This is not a malicious statement against the media, but there is not a lot of representation of all people in our media. And there is something that obviously the media sees in the profoundly tragic murder of a woman from Vermont that continues to have that story on the front page of our Globe and other things that unfortunately we don't see when 10 people are murdered by a white supremacist, a self-proclaimed white supremacist, who, oh, by the way, was taken into custody after killing 10 people and harming 3 others without a scratch on him and lived to be held accountable. And I am confident he will be. But if we don't talk out loud about the fact that unarmed people of color and black people in particular die during encounters with police, and armed white supremacists live after killing Dylann Roof, after killing 9 people in South Carolina, and this individual after killing 10 people and harming 3 others, 2 of whom were white, because, you know, racism doesn't see color sometimes when they are engaged in their behavior. It's really, really just profoundly sad. And we have to really get comfortable being uncomfortable talking about race and the rise of domestic violent extremism, in particular with respect to race and ethnicity in our country. It's the number one threat, according to the FBI.
So I want to talk about that, too. There are several things I'd like to pick up from there. Since you mentioned the FBI, let's stay there. We know that domestic white extremism is, Homeland Security using a variety of expressions like violent white supremacist extremists. Homeland Security has called them a real terrorist threat, one of the top internet, security threats on American soil. You've just mentioned the FBI. You talked with GBH in a recent report about regional collaboration between agencies regarding right-wing extremist organizations. How is that collaboration working? Are you talking with the FBI as part of that? Have you had conversations directly with them? And what's the approach here in the Commonwealth?
As the chief federal law enforcement officer in our state, I speak to the FBI all the time. They are essentially, one of the largest, if not the leading federal agency that we work with respect to law enforcement. Special Agent in Charge Bonavalenta and I speak often, and we speak, unfortunately, to impacted communities all the time, whether it be the Jewish community, whether it be the black community. We've had discussions, or I personally have had meetings with other impacted communities, LGBTQIA+, Muslim and Sikh communities as well. What we're doing is we're educating people about the difference between hate incidents and hate crimes, and that there can be civil remedies in some circumstances and criminal remedies in others, and all the different places they can go with the federal government, the state government, or locally if something like that happens. And, I just want to correct one thing you said. Domestic violent extremism, particularly with respect to racial and ethnic extremism, is the number one threat. Not one of the threats. It is the number one threat regarding domestic terrorism in our country. So, it's really important that we talk about that.
So I want to ask you in follow-up to that. Here in Massachusetts, are we clear-eyed? Do we know, do we understand the size and scope of organized white violent extremist groups here in Massachusetts? I think we tend to have a conversation that happens elsewhere and those groups aren't organized here.
I do believe that we often are a little bit naive about what happens here in our Commonwealth. I was the district attorney of Suffolk County when Nathan Allen murdered 2 black people in Winthrop after he stole a box truck and crashed it in the beautiful town of Winthrop. And also, I was the DA when a rabbi was stabbed brutally and luckily lived in Brighton. And so those were 2 cases where we know, one, we've charged it as a hate crime with respect to the rabbi. And Nathan Allen, with his sort of manifesto, for lack of a better word, and what his phone was looking at as he crashed his truck, we know what his intent was there. As the U.S. attorney, we have, unfortunately, several church burning cases in Massachusetts, in Springfield. A historically black church was burned to the ground, and we just indicted somebody for that. We've seen Jewish facilities, attempted burnings of those facilities as well. And it's really profoundly sad that we are dealing with those types of crimes, with that malicious intent in 2020, 2021, and 2022 in Massachusetts.
So what do we do now? 2 years later, renewed attention right now because of the two-year anniversary this week of George Floyd. Mixed results in the progress in America. What's the top priority from your perspective here in the Commonwealth as our U.S. attorney?
The top priority is speaking out about these, educating people about the fact that these things are happening, and then also explaining to communities that feel fear, quite frankly. After the Tops massacre, there are people in Buffalo and there are people here in Massachusetts that might have a loved one in Buffalo or see something of themselves in that community or somebody that was murdered there that are fearful. I think that situation also exposes, now there's a food desert in that community, right? Tops was one of the only supermarkets in that area that sort of catered to the Black community and had prices that were affordable. And so, you know, whether those individuals could or couldn't go to a Trader Joe's or a Whole Foods, we now know more than when the murders occurred back on May 14th that the individual had gone to Tops multiple times and looked specifically for that location. I want us to be vigilant. I want us to be aware of things that are happening in our community. And I want to make sure as the chief federal law enforcement officer that I'm speaking to impacted communities so that they know that their federal government cares and is going to try to do everything we can to educate you as well as hold people accountable if they engage in this behavior. But to hear my voice say that the U.S. Attorney's Office and the FBI and our other state, local, and federal law enforcement officers are actively working to try to disrupt and find people with this ideology before they engage in these acts of violence.
Before we say goodbye to you, I want to ask you a question on one other subject. There's news out recently that you've launched a civil rights investigation into Quincy's resistance to rebuild the Long Island Bridge. What's the thought with that investigation, and can you give us an update on how it's going?
So we did send a letter to Quincy. I paid the mayor the courtesy of a call prior to sending that letter and to alert him that that was going to happen. And what we want to do is just, we read the news just like everyone else. We want to make sure, and it's just an inquiry, we are making no allegations yet, but that there was nothing that ran afoul of the Americans with Disabilities Act. When we think about Quincy, you know, I believe Marina Bay is in Quincy, and was there the same reaction when Marina Bay was erected, for lack of a better word, as there is now with respect to this bridge? We are happy to hear that the mayor has made it clear that he's going to respond to our letter, and we look forward to that discussion, but that will be the extent of my comments.
Okay. Thank you very much for that. The U.S. Attorney, former Suffolk County DA Rachel Rollins, joining us again on this two-year anniversary week of the murder of George Floyd at the hand of Minneapolis police. I appreciated talking to you then, and I appreciate talking to you now.
Absolutely. Be well.
We're bringing you a small set of weekly conversations on leadership here on the show. We call the series Stepping Up. It's all about talking with folks in and around Greater Boston who are making deep change in their communities. And on a day like today, that idea of community hits home a little harder. It feels really present because in the moments that truly challenge us, that's when our communities matter the most. Last week, we heard from Reverend Willie Bodrick, senior pastor at the historic 12th Baptist Church in Roxbury. Before that, we spoke with Doug Rao, food security pioneer and founder of the nonprofit grocery chain Daily Table. Today, we are joined by a true force in the nonprofit world, Gita Pradhan, president of the Cambridge Community Foundation. Gita, welcome.
Thank you.
I appreciate having you here. We were going to go a different direction with this prior to the events of this week. It's a perfect opportunity, though, with you as a head of a community foundation to talk about stepping up in communities. And so I'm glad you're here. And I'm just going to begin by asking you what community means to you.
You know, community is it's a complex concept. On the one hand, it could be just a collection of people, but it's a collection of so many different kinds of people, of institutions, of different actors, of corporations and the like. And the coming together of all of these entities at times like the one that we are presently, you know, dealing with is what really says what community truly is. It's the ability to come together, to heal, to connect, to help. That's what community means to me.
What about communities allow us to heal each other, help each other?
Say that again. I'm sort of missed you.
The building blocks.
The building blocks.
Yeah, sorry.
Yeah. You know, there are different actors within the community. So, for instance, the faith community, at this point, that's a very critical aspect of community. There are the nonprofits, there's philanthropy, and there are the everyday people. And I really put my ultimate faith in the everyday people, because that's where the connections are, the families, the individuals, the you know, the teachers, the schools. There's so many places. Those are the smaller building blocks that come together and create the larger sense of community.
You know, we wanted to talk to you. I met you more than a decade ago.
Yeah.
In the world of philanthropy, I was running nonprofits. And I want to mark that I think most people really don't know much about the world of philanthropy.
Yeah.
It's the internecine battles about whether they're maintaining the status quo or changing the status quo. But one thing I know about you is you pushed against that. We thought of you as a disruptor. And I wonder how you feel about being called a disruptor. Is that who you are?
Actually, I like that term. And I think it's a term that we need to lift up. Because when I think about what philanthropy is about and what the role of philanthropy is and should be a disruptor. It should be the force that sort of challenges status quo. Just to give you an example about just my own, why I came to disrupt, some of it is that I was deeply rooted in community, and most of my work was deeply rooted in community before I came into philanthropy. And I remember a conversation I had with Sister Virginia Morrison of the from Grove Hall, from Muhammad's Mosque, who said to me, we were talking about economic development, and she said, In most other community, a dollar turns around several times, and in Grove Hall, it sleeps one night and leaves. It was a off sort of hand comment, but it really made me start thinking about the fact that there has been a problem that has been persistent in our communities for not just you know, few years or a few months, but for decades and almost generations. So we have generational issues in the community, and it made me sort of question, why does that happen and what are we doing about it? And then when you look across philanthropy, what we have fallen into is filling the gaps where government services are not providing the services that they were supposed to be providing, whether it's workforce or education or healthcare. Philanthropy has fallen into the trap of filling in those gaps, whereas what I think we should be doing is questioning those gaps, using research to point, to shine the light on issues, to point out to problems, to experiment, to innovate. You know, for instance, we just recently did a Guaranteed Basic Income project in Cambridge.
We had actually had Mayor
Siddiqui
on the show yesterday talking about
it. Yes. So we had that 130 families working on, you know, getting guaranteed basic income for 18 months. But what we've done is now we've turned that project that was fully funded by philanthropy. The next stage of that is advocacy around that idea that has led to the city making a $22 million commitment for every family under 200% of poverty that will get cash assistance through ARPA. Now, this isn't
American Rescue Plan Act.
American Rescue Plan Act, yes. And so this isn't something that I think government would naturally do. But philanthropy, in a sense, paved the way for that. And there are many examples like that, you know, where philanthropy can step forward, experiment, push an idea. You're familiar with some of those. You did some of those in Grove Hall, I remember. And that opens up the space for the public sector, which is where the larger pool of funds are, or for the corporate sector to step up and expand what they're doing. They will never be the ones who will do the innovation. They will do the expansion. So I feel like that's what philanthropy's role should be, to question, to push, to innovate.
So let's talk about leadership in a couple of spaces.
Yeah.
One, you spent time at the Boston Foundation.
Yeah.
While you were there, you helped create the Boston Indicators Project to differently measure the well-being of our neighborhoods and communities. That really sticks with me because a couple of weeks ago, Michael Curry, the head of the Massachusetts League of Community Health Centers, was here as part of a new consortium that is pushing for healthcare equity.
Mm-hmm.
And when I asked, well, what do we do? He said, well, we've got to measure the cost of healthcare differently. We have to look at the racial cost of healthcare. We have to look at the long-term life costs of receiving poorer outcomes.
Mm-hmm.
What were we measuring that we needed to measure differently? And what are we measuring wrong now?
That's interesting. You know, I think for one, our approach to measuring community change was very siloed. So, you know, we are measuring educational outcomes. You know, we are measuring health outcomes. We are measuring income outcomes.
Separately.
But really, if you think of it, and I know that there has been research done on these, I think it was the Boston Police Department several years ago that did some tracking of it was actually around violence, about where violence was coming from. And they were able to sort of narrow it down to, you know, a couple of households that it was emanating from. But what it did say was that those families were dealing with a whole host of problems. You know, it wasn't a single issue. It wasn't as though, you can track violence to someone who's just in poverty, for instance, you know. Or it might be, you know, it might be that the person who's sort of perpetrating the violence could be a person who has mental health issues, you know, has dropped out of school, has family traumas. So there are multiple issues that actually affect the outcomes of anything, whether it's in education or income or healthcare or whatever. And so the idea of trying to look at this across issues and look at the interconnections between issues, I think, is the important thing. So I think that's something that I would say the Robert Wood Johnson Foundation, for instance, really did lead the way on social determinants of health.
Which are those inputs to your health outcomes, like food security, housing,
education, your income status, and your health status. So there are other issues that actually really contribute to the health outcomes of a person. You know, when we're looking at the issue of education, too, you're seeing the same thing. If you look at the issue of education equity and kids in public schools who are not doing well, particularly black and brown kids, you see the same thing. If you were to track it back, you would see that there are a whole host of issues
systemic
that are affecting
issues.
Their outcomes. Yeah.
So I'm going to flag that research. It was a little more than a decade ago. The Boston Police Department was involved in it. So was an academic institution. I don't remember which one.
I don't remember either.
The focus of that research on the time was on the fact that about 80% of the arraignments in Boston could be traced back to a smaller subset of families. It was very controversial at the time.
Yeah.
On the one hand, I think part of, because I was in some of those rooms.
Yeah.
On one hand, part of the emphasis was on providing a surrounding of supports for families. On the other hand, there was worry that it was family blaming rather than system blaming.
Right.
And I, excuse me, I want to stay in that space with you now. So now you're in charge. So you disrupt, now you're in charge.
Yes.
And I want to ask you to put a hard light on that.
Yeah.
A community foundation is responsible for funding programs in a targeted community with money coming from people in that community. What is it like when now you're in charge and you're responsible for the framing? You're responsible for holding
yes.
up the light.
So first of all, I say I love it. I love it because when you have that opportunity, that leadership opportunity, and you have had the experience of having done similar things in spaces where maybe you were not in charge, you know, now you're in a space where you can really set direction for those kinds of things. And I really think that philanthropy has to become bolder, you know. I think it's a criticism even of my own self, you know, is that often when you're in running philanthropic organizations, the tendency is to follow what everyone else is doing. And for instance, you know, we are looking at the issue of education, and on June 8th, we are hosting a forum on education. And what we are talking about is that the outcomes for children are not just the responsibility of the schools. So the title of our forum is A Just Education, Our Youth, Our Responsibility. What is the responsibility of the community, and how can we bring people together? So community foundation, one of the powers of a community foundation is that we can be, besides being grant makers, which I think is a small piece of what we do, we can be civic leaders, we can be conveners, connectors, and catalysts for change. We are neutral entities that can bring people together. And that is the power that I think we are trying to leverage. We don't always have the answers. You know, the answers are with the people who are living, who have the lived experience of an issue. The answers are with the nonprofits who are working closely with the people who have the lived experiences of issues. How do we lift those up? How do we bring them together with experts and create that kind of, you know, do that kind of sausage making that actually results in solutions that are unusual, that are people may not have thought about?
So at the top of the show, Reverend Mariama White Hammond was here from New Roots AME Church. And as we were wrapping that conversation, she was talking about what it would mean to have a truly pro-child Greater Boston. What could you do as a philanthropic leader? And what would it look like to push forward approaches that were truly pro-child?
Yes. I would say that, you know, first of all, really shining the light on data to show that you know, this issue that we've forever talked about in education, about academic achievement, is not really an academic achievement issue, which puts sort of the blame on the child or the teacher for their inability to have the outcomes. But it is really about an opportunity gap that has been created, you know, that Dr. Janet Moses talks about a lot. And so I think it's shining the light on the myriad of issues that I think affect a child's life and affect children's outcomes, and holding the different actors responsible, or holding them accountable. What role do corporations have to play in this game? You know, what can they do? Can they mentor? Can they provide internship? Can they create those opportunities? What do we as everyday individuals in the community do? You know, what do other public departments do? Why do we expect the schools to deal with the nutrition, the mental health, the parent engagement? Every outcome, every aspect that affects a child's life is put on the school system. And our school systems across the country are failing, our public school systems. I think we have to look at this differently. We have to think about this differently. And I feel that the role that we can play in philanthropy is one of, again, you know, pushing ideas, supporting grassroots-led ideas, because those are the people who are living those experiences. We run this
That's
one.
That's where the wisdom is.
Yeah.
That is Geeta Pradhan, president of the Cambridge Community Foundation, for our series Stepping Up. Geeta, thank you.
Thank you.
And that's our show for today. Radio Boston is a production of 90.9 WBUR, Boston's NPR news station. I'm Tiziana Deering. Thanks for joining us today. Tune in again tomorrow for more Radio Boston.